Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, John Clayton.
Welcome to Schooled with the Professor, and of course we get another education this week. Doug Farrar joins us, and can't believe Doug, you know, he just got hired by USA Today, and he's been over doing great stuff, and now he wrote a book. How about that? The Genius of Desperation, which is called The Schematic Innovations That Made the NFL and the Modern NFL Offenses and Defenses and all that stuff. And so, Doug, let's first get into what got you to do the book.
Well, thanks, John, and thanks for having me on. It was about 6 years ago, I read a book called Inverting the Pyramid by Jonathan Wilson, an English author, and it was the chronological tactical history of soccer, what we call soccer. They would be offended by that. They call it football. And I thought, well, with all the books that have been written about the NFL since formed in 1920, there has to be a chronological, you know, history, schematic history of professional football. And then I went out and couldn't find one. And I thought, well, gosh, that's a book I'd like to read. So I spent the next, you know, I spent 3 years essentially writing a book I wanted to read, and hopefully I nailed it. But yeah, you know, there have been great schematic books. Obviously, The Games That Changed the Game by Greg Cosell and Ron Jaworski. Take Your Eye Off the Ball by Pat Kerwin, who I know we both know. But I hadn't seen something that went back to the earliest days and sort of brought it up to the modern era. And the Genius of Desperation title really came about through the more I studied this, the more I realized that no real innovation in NFL history has come about through anything but desperation. You look at Bill Walsh creating the West Coast offense as Cincinnati's offensive coordinator in 1969 after Greg Cook gets hurt. And they have a backup quarterback in Virgil Carter who can't really throw that well. So all of a sudden you got, you know, your flare passes and all that that Walsh learned from Sid Gilman. And, you know, you have the West Coast offense. You have a Miami team in 2008, 0-2. They'd been 1-15 the year before. They're flying back from Arizona, who had just kicked their tails, back to Miami. And Tony Sperano, who unfortunately just recently passed, goes to David Lee, the quarterback's coach, and says, okay, that thing you've been talking about, you ran it with Darren McFadden and Felix Jones at Arkansas the year before, with that Wildcat thing. Why don't you break that, see what that looks like? And the Wildcat didn't last too long, but week three, they foiled the New England Patriots with it, which was pretty incredible. And the more I looked at schematic innovations through the NFL's history, the more I saw desperation as the primary motivator. You're facing a team or you're in a season where you don't have the players to do what you want to do. You have to outthink your opponent because you can't out-execute them. You don't have the talent they do. You have to come up with something new and push it forward. And from 1920 to the present day, where in last year's Super Bowl, how do we beat the Patriots with Nick Foles as our quarterback? Well, we double down on our RPOs, and we put together a passing game that our quarterback can understand. But this, you know, it wasn't the plan to win the Super Bowl with Nick Foles. They did it out of desperation, and Doug Peterson and Frank Reich and John DeFilippo came together and said, okay, we need to create a different arc for how this works. And from, you know, Clark Shaughnessy, you know, really expanding the T formation in the 1930s through Sid Gilman and Bill Walsh and, you know, all these different innovators. That was really the common point I saw, was that desperation breeds innovation in most businesses, but most certainly in the NFL. It was the thing that kept coming up over and over.
Interesting. So let's kind of we'll go now and then go backwards. But let's take now. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the RPO, and I guess, you know, you can say to some degree the Wildcat was just a fling. The RPO is something that I think has more durability. Kind of take us through the innovations of the RPO and what it currently stands in this league.
Sure. Well, the Wildcat, I mean, it was basically three plays: Steeler, power, and counter. And, you know, you went over this loaded tackle or that loaded tackle, or you did a counter reverse and you had a couple of pass plays, and it was really easy to figure out. And the RPO is really easy to figure out, but what teams are finding, and I talked pretty extensively with Jim Schwartz, Philly's defensive coordinator, who obviously has to face the RPO in practice all the time. I talked to a lot of New England's defensive players in the week leading up to the Super Bowl. And the difference with the RPO, there are a couple of things. The reason it's not going away, or the reasons. Number one, as Schwartz told me, there really isn't a way to defend it constantly because it's a post-snap read. So you can't really, I mean, you can disguise it to a point, and you can put your linebacker out in the curl flat area where you think the RPO read might happen. But more and more, and Dallas was running what you would call three-level RPOs last year, where you have the run option if the defense stays back, or if the linebacker bites on the play fake, then you've got that open area in the middle of the field. That's sort of the one-level RPO. Well, if that doesn't work and you don't want to hand the ball off and you want to draw the defense in with a play fake, you might have a backside slant. You might have a levels concept where you've got like a simple flare route and then an out and a post. So the thing with the RPO is it's more expansive than simple play action because it allows the quarterback to put one defender on a string. So it's basically the old zone read, but with a passing element and more multiple passing elements. I mean, when you look at, let's go with Patrick Mahomes, who's the hottest quarterback in the NFL right now. His simple slant touchdown pass to Tyreek Hill in week one against the Chargers, all he was doing was reading Denzel Perryman, the linebacker, and Perryman cheated up on the play fake to Kareem Hunt. And Tyreek Hill was running a front side slant, so Mahomes knew in that millisecond he had Hill open. So this isn't like you're coming to the line and saying, this is the play we're going to run. You're coming to the line saying, we're going to run an RPO. This is the run concept. This is the pass concept. Quarterback decides based on the actions of generally one, possibly two defenders, but it's really kind of an if this, then that thing. And the reason it works is because you're not waiting for defensive displacement. You're creating it or not with the play fake. If the linebacker bites on the play fake or the safety bites on the play fake, then you know you have an open receiver based on the route concept. If the linebacker stays back, you simply hand off, or the safety, you know, stays back, you hand off, you go to that area. I mean, I've had coaches tell me over the last 2 or 3 years, more and more it's a matchup league, it's a spacing league, and the RPO takes advantage of that brilliantly. The other thing about the RPO is it does not require a mobile quarterback. And I think people get that wrong all the time, like, oh, it's an option thing, so you have to be Michael Vick. Last time I checked, John, Nick Foles is not a mobile guy.
No.
And he runs the RPO pretty well. It's more about, you know, staying in the pocket, selling that play fake. Now, if you have a mobile quarterback who can add an additional option element to the RPO, then it's more dangerous than ever. And it's why I would love to see, for example, the Seahawks run more 2 and 3 level RPOs, because I think Wilson's a perfect quarterback for it. But in a nutshell, the reason the RPO isn't going away is because there are more diverse elements to it, because it's a post-snap concept. The quarterback decides where the ball goes, and it's pretty easy to pick up.
So talking to Jim Schwartz and some of the defensive coordinators, what's going to be, because ultimately these guys figure some things out, what's going to be some of the solutions to try to stop the run-pass option?
Well, I mean, there are certain things you can do. You can disguise coverages, and some quarterbacks are not, because a lot of, you know, they're making it easier for Mahomes, they're making it easier for Trubisky. Less experienced quarterbacks with the RPO. You can disguise coverages. And generally speaking, the passing option in the RPO is a short pass. It's either, you know, a skinny slant or a crossing route or some sort of flare pattern. Get in that curl flat area and get somebody open. You can see guys jumping routes on that. You can see an unseen defender sort of hanging back at the last minute. But as Schwartz told me, you can do that stuff, but there really isn't any way to defend the RPO down to down. And that was a remarkable thing for an NFL defensive coordinator to say. And, you know, Schwartz is one of the smartest guys in football. He's got, I believe, an econ degree. He's been on the, you know, all about sabermetrics for a long time. He studies hard, and he has for years. And for that coach to say, because of the post-snap element, there really isn't any way to stop RPOs down to down. I mean, it's why it took over high school football in the 90s, took over college football really in the late 2000s to now. I wrote something about Urban Meyer telling a guy from X&O Labs that by 2014, the RPO would take over college football, which has proved the case. I don't think you can run the RPO as your primary passing construct in the NFL, because unless you have a Tyreek Hill, there aren't huge plays to be made from it. The Eagles and the Chiefs, I believe, led the league running about, per Pro Football Focus, if I'm remembering this correctly, about 17% of their plays were RPOs. So it's kind of like, you know, a dime defense or a 46 defense. It's not your base element, but when you throw it in there, it becomes really hard to defend. And, you know, and everyone's looking for the thing that stops the RPO. I don't think anyone's figured it out yet.
Here's an interesting observation, because I know doing the sidelines on the Bears game, interesting thing I picked up on it the week before. You know, Mitch Trubisky had great success with the script, you know, 15, 17 plays, and that's one thing I think you can see Matt Nagy coming from Kansas City gave him. And like last week in week one, I think he had like 19 plays, 149 yards. You saw, I think he had 89 yards in the first 17 plays against the Seahawks. And then once he got off the script, everything just collapsed. And so he uses RPOs, and they have a nice running attack, and you know that Nagy's very creative at it. But what is it when you go from a non-script with a quarterback like Trubisky, who's not the most accurate guy? He's, you know, starting to get better, but he still has some difficulties. Because I know I said on the air, I said, now you watch, he's off the script, something can happen. And the very next play, he throws an interception. What happens to the RPO guys once you're off the script?
Well, the thing about Trubisky, he started 1 year in college, and then he was in that really horrible, regressive Chicago offense last year. So now everyone's thinking, oh, well, you know, Matt Nagy comes in, and it'll be like when Sean McVay turned Jared Goff into Cinderella. I think with Trubisky, there's a lot for him to learn. And the thing about Nagy's offense, as we saw with Kansas City last year, when he merged his concepts with Andy Reid's and it was really successful, you turned Alex Smith into the most prolific deep passer in the league, and when did you ever think you were going to hear that? Nagy's offense, there's a lot of pre-snap motion. There's a lot of post-snap reads. You have to read your backside receiver. You have to see the whole field. Trubisky is just not prepared to do that yet. And so I don't think you've seen the entire Matt Nagy offense, because Nagy understands he's got to reduce his concepts at this point in time to present things that his quarterback can understand and execute. As far as the script, I mean, Bill Walsh was really the first guy to script, say, the first 15 plays. And when we talk about scripting, we're talking about creating a rhythm. And it can be, you know, a one or two play check. Like if they're running this defense, then you go to this play. And if they're running this defense, you go to that play. Scripts can help with no huddle. They can certainly help with offensive rhythm, because you're designing, it's not just play after play after play. It's a series of plays that you, as the offensive coordinator and play designer and head coach, you're hoping can run sequentially and sort of create forward momentum. Sometimes it works. We don't really hear about the scripts that don't work, and those happen too. With Trubisky, I think the scripts give him a couple of simple options, and then a couple of simple options off those simple options. I think the scripts help him read a defense, and those checks help him understand what he's dealing with. And I think on the fly, he's going to regress to more of a sandlot element, simply because, and I think Trubisky has all the tools to be successful. He just doesn't have the experience to take an NFL offense in hand and deploy it against NFL defenses, which are, you know, the NFL is so much more advanced than it was even 10 years ago. I mean, 10 years ago, a slot corner or a slot receiver was the guy who wasn't good enough to be a quote unquote starter. And now nickel is the new base defense. You've got, you know, two-man slot formations and all sorts of things happening. So I think with Trubisky, the script gives him a sense of familiarity and a sense of momentum. And when he's off the script and he has to sort of decide things by himself in conjunction with the game plan he's given, there are going to be some off plays because he's just, you know, I don't want to say he's not ready, but he's not ready for the full bore NFL offense and NFL defense yet. So when you have a reductive playbook with a young quarterback, mistakes will be made. Now, Aaron Rodgers doesn't need a script. Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Russell Wilson, these guys, you could argue that Russell Wilson is better when he doesn't have a script. Just let him sort of do what he does, and everyone talks about the, you know, just give him no huddle and whatever. With a young quarterback like Trubisky, and it certainly helped Joe Montana when Walsh started scripting the first 15, when Montana was a young quarterback, you're trying to create rhythm and momentum and a sense of comfort for the quarterback because, you know, that's the other thing. You want your quarterback to be comfortable. You want him to have faith in his first read. I remember when McVay went to the Rams, one of the first things he told Jared Goff was, your first read will always be open. Trust it. So you're creating a sense of trust for the quarterback in the system. And I think over time it'll help Trubisky. He's just, you know, he's kind of been putting the dryer on full, and it's going to take a while for him to figure it all out.
Let's do some historical quick hits. Okay, you mentioned Bill Walsh. To kind of take us, what was the next step from the West Coast offense and what developed out of desperation there to you know, what happened next?
Well, a few things. Again, Walsh created the Greg Cook out of Cincinnati was, I believe, the number one pick in the 1969 AFL draft. And Walsh, to his dying day, said that if Greg Cook had stayed healthy, he would have been the best quarterback of all time. Everyone believed this. And at the time, Walsh ran kind of a Sid Gilman system, you know, three-digit vertical, the standard offense of the American Football League in the 1960s. And then second or third game, Jim Lynch, linebacker for the Chiefs, hits Cook and Cook tears up his shoulder. And obviously the medical was not what it is now. So Walsh had to adapt to what became the West Coast offense. Well, out of the West Coast offense, Dick LeBeau he didn't invent the zone blitz, but he perfected the zone blitz as more of a constant construct to put defensive players, especially front seven defensive players, in places the quarterback did not expect. And when you have, you know, quick hit here and quick hit there and a screen pass and a flare pass and a quick slant to Jerry Rice and, you know, here goes Roger Craig with the screen, what LeBeau wanted to do was because at that point you're throwing everything under the defense for the 5 yard gain and the 6 yard gain, and it's death by 1,000 paper cuts. And what LeBeau wanted to do was to hurry the quarterback's vision and execution by dropping a defensive player from the front seven into coverage that was unexpected and blitzing with a safety or a cornerback. And it not only sped up the count, but it skewed the quarterback's vision. So the West Coast offense, I mean, there are West Coast offense principles to this day. But the main thing that came out of a response to what Walsh was doing was the zone blitz. Now, there had been zone blitzes going back to the early 1960s in the AFL. The Patriots, when they were the Boston Patriots, actually ran them a lot. But LeBeau's zone blitz was really kind of the gold standard. And, you know, James Harrison's 100-yard interception in Super Bowl 43 was his own blitz. So you still see that today.
And then finally, where does Big Nickel sit in there? Kind of like in a 30-second summation. Does Big Nickel mm-hmm. have answers to some of the things going on today? And Big Nickel, of course, being three safeties.
Sure. And, you know, cornerbacks and safeties are not really cornerbacks and safeties. They're so much more interchangeable than they used to be. And it really, like with anything else, it depends on your personnel. If your safety is a traditional free or strong, then it's a little more restrictive. But if you have three safeties who can really move around, and the Patriots have done so well with this, with Daron Harmon and Patrick Chung, they move guys in and out, their corners become safeties, their safeties become corners. Big Nickel it's one more of those sub-package things where you're not going to see on every down, but certainly if we swing it back to the RPO discussion, can you disguise things with three safeties that you can't with three corners? Well, certainly. And with those post-snap quick reads that the RPO allows, defensively, you want to create quick confusion. And if you can have three versatile safeties, as the Patriots often have, you can start to foil some of those concepts. So, again, you know, from the early days of pro football to now, it's, oh, this guy invented this, we have to counter with that. And it just keeps going and going and going. And it's not going to stop anytime soon.
Well, of course, that can be your next book as far as some of those other changes. All right, so where can everybody get The Genius of Desperation by Doug Farrar?
Well, thank you, John. The Genius of Desperation, you can find it in Barnes & Noble stores now and on Amazon September 25th, next Tuesday. The Kindle will be out then. I know a lot of people have pre-ordered, and I greatly appreciate that. It'll hit your Kindle on September 25th. So you can look up Genius of Desperation on Amazon.com or go to Triumph Books, and you can see it there, and hope people enjoy it.
Hey, Doug Farrar, thanks for educating us on Schooled with the Professor with The Genius of Desperation.
Thanks, John.
And that does it for this week's podcast. In between episodes, you can follow me on Twitter at ClaytonESPN. If you enjoy these weekly one-on-one conversations, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Schooled with the Professor. Professor.